You'll be in the mode now of analyzing songs. And this is a tough thing to do sometimes, because this can easily be done with a critical spirit. And there's an academic way of being of critical thinking, of critical analysis, without a critical spirit. And sometimes those things get kind of mixed in together. So I just want to say that as a caution here. The intention for this is not for us to criticize, but to be able to think critically. So I mentioned some of the rationale for the survey stuff, national worship leaders, email list, integrity music. I used a technique called free recall, which is basically asking an open-ended question, like which song has brought you hope. The reason for that is Dan Gilbert, a psychologist at Harvard, and others have talked about how free recall, when you ask a person to remember something or recall something, they don't usually pick the most typical event, but they pick the most memorable event. So parents, this is bad news for us. You know, when our kids one day grow up and are in therapy, they will not remember all the wonderful normal days, but they will remember that one thing you said. You're right, no, hopefully they won't remember. But this is sort of how free recall works, is you tend to pick out the things that stand out rather than the most average or the most typical. So I wanted that. I didn't want the most average song or the most sort of common song. It's why I didn't do a CCLI analysis. So a lot of other song studies do CCLI analysis. Nothing wrong with that. But all the CCLI lists tell us is which songs are most sung or most popularly sung. And furthermore, there's complications there, because CCLI is influenced by market forces and radio charts. And so there's, I just wanted, from a worship leader standpoint, What are the songs that brought you hope? Finally, you will notice here that all of this analysis focuses on lyrics. And so invariably when I present this, people will ask, well, why didn't you think about the key of the song, major key, minor key, the arrangements, the music, any of the musical aspects of this? The reason I didn't is because music is a variable. There's a sociologist who studies ritual. His name's Roy Rappaport. And Rappaport talks about how in any ritual, there are rituals can be variant or invariant. So let's put it this way. The ritual of greeting someone in the morning could be anywhere from, hey, what's up, or morning, or top of the morning to you, or, good morning, sunshine, or whatever. There's a range of variants, right? But what's normal is that there's some sort of greeting when you see someone for the first time in a day. So invariant is when, this is what is said. Now, song lyrics are invariant. You typically don't change the lyrics of a song. Now, I know some of you do. You're not supposed to do that, right? So typically song lyrics are invariant. When you sing a song, you're going to sing it as it's written, right? Furthermore, Rappaport differentiates between what he calls canonical messages and indexical messages. Those are technical terms. What he means by that is indexical messages are all the messages that are sent in the process of communicating the thing you were supposed to communicate. If I said, Sonny, would you please tell Jim I had to leave? And you said, okay, those are the words, Glenn had to leave. But you go, hey Jim, Glenn had to leave. That's all of the body language and the tone is what Rappaport calls the indexical messages. It's all the extra stuff. But the canonical message is Glenn had to leave. That's what I told you to say, and you carried that out. It was coded in, is another way to say it. It was coded in. You have to say this. Song lyrics are canonical messages. The music, you might play a song in a number of different ways. You might play it with a huge band, you might play it with a small, even just an acoustic guitar, you might sing it a little faster, you might sing it a little slower, you might ramp up the chord, I can't control all of that. But the canonical message of a song is its words, right? So that's why, folks, for some of you, that just does not matter at all for my rationale. For others of you, you're totally geeking out on research methodology. There you go. A little breakdown here. One of you asked what was the demographic breakdown. I'm not showing you here by gender or by other things. I had some other demographic info in there, but just for today, just look at the denominational breakdown of the 966 worship leaders. Most of them Baptist. I was with a group recently who said, you can't just say Baptist. What kind of Baptist, you know? And I said, yeah, I should have asked, you know, Southern Baptist, American Baptist, General Baptist. There's even another one.
Independent.
Right, Independent Baptist. I mean, there's a lot of Baptists. So I probably should have been more specific there. Yeah, mainline Protestant is a lumping together of Presbyterian, Lutheran, Methodist, Anglican, Episcopal, all that. Pentecostal Charismatic actually is Vineyard and Assemblies of God. I have Presbyterians on their own. Oh, I know why I had them on their own, because I'm studying Presbyterian. I did a Presbyterian church in the studies. I needed to break them out. Catholic, 4%. Which, for Integrity Music's mailing list, I thought, oh, all right, we've got some Catholics there, which is great. Okay, these were the questions. Name a worship song that brought you hope in a time of despair. 966 worship leaders, 752 responses, 844 song responses, 414 unique songs, 33 songs mentioned 5 times or more. Can you follow track with all that? Yeah.
Those songs in the CCLI top 25?
No. Top songs were the songs mentioned 5 times or more. So I think it's 33 songs compared to all the other 414 minus 33. I think that would be the right math. Be pretty close, wouldn't it? Yeah, 10% of 4. Yeah, okay. And then this, song responses. So out of 844 song responses, the 33 songs mentioned 5 times or more accounted for 40% of the responses. There we go. Okay. I had to remember what these charts indicated. In other words, 8% of the songs accounted for 40% of the responses. That's another way to think of it. Okay, so that's
pretty good.
Yeah. All right. Now, I asked a different question. Name a worship song you sing at church that usually brings you hope. Wait a minute. Why did this one not show up? There's another. Weird. Okay. On my screen, I can see 2 pie charts, and on here, there's only one. That's weird. Anyway, 8%, 38%, not a big difference there, but different question. Okay. When I aggregated the responses, these were the top 5. No. Trigger warnings, you know, songs you had to sing too many times, maybe. You know.
What are the 25s?
Yes, so because there were 2 different questions, I took the total number of mentions divided by 2. Does that make sense? So yeah, that's why you end up with the 0.5. So in essence, Good Father appeared 81 times between those 2 questions. All right, it is well. The Bethel one, not the hymn. Although there was some confusion there, because some people did specify (parentheses) Bethel, others put "It Is Well with My Soul," hymn. You know, so I tried to screen those out, but where it was ambiguous, I did say Bethel. So that's the only one that could be a little bit off. It's tough when you give open-ended questions, because you can't fully control how people respond. In Christ alone, no longer slaves, and cornerstone. Now, when you split it out by, I wanted to see what about just the AG and Vineyard worship leaders, what songs did they name? So same 966, but just with a few filters on, so let's just get one slice. There were 104, so of the 966 is 104. Were AG and Vineyard, 88 responses, 88 song responses, 76 unique songs. That's pretty good. you know, out of 88 responses. Only 7 songs mentioned more than twice to this question, so 9% of the songs make up 19% of the responses. Then that second question, name a worship song you sing at church that usually brings you hope. Similar kind of stuff here, 15 songs, but this time there's 15 songs mentioned more than twice, so a lot more songs are mentioned. It's a bigger list to choose from. Aggregate the two lists. You get It Is Well, Good Good Father, Great Are You Lord, Still, Cornerstone, and No Longer Slaves. You guys know all these songs?
Yes.
Is there any song you don't know on here?
I don't know still.
Reuben Morgan.
When the ocean dries and thunders roll, I will soar with you above the snows.
Which street are you in?
Sons and Daughters. Yep.
You are like you.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to Presbyterians. All right, these are our Presbyterians. Only 26 Presbyterian worship leaders, but 23 of them responded with this 33 song responses, which means some of them named more than one song. And a lot of songs to choose from. 31 unique songs. It's a lot. Only 2 songs mentioned twice. I didn't want to make too much of this, but it seems like Presbyterians had more songs to choose from, you know? Or at least were able to recall more. Like, oh, this one. Oh, and this one. And, you know, I'm just imagining here, non-scientifically. 6% made up 12% of the responses. Second question, similar kind of thing, but here only 1 song is mentioned twice.
Wow.
Okay, they had a whole bunch of songs to choose from. So it was tough to kind of come up with a top list, but this is what it was. You had to go with the ones that were mentioned twice. In Christ Alone, not surprising, right? Boldly I Approach, some of these I was not really familiar with. Cornerstone, there's Reuben Morgan's again. Jesus, I My Cross Have Taken, I did not know that. I had to look up lyrics. And then Still. Just kind of good. Tell me if I'm in your way. You sure?
Yeah.
Okay. Now I'm in your way. How can I be in your way? Okay. Now, if we put it all together, from general list to charismatic list to Presbyterian list, there you go. So Cornerstone is the one song that's on all 3 lists. Well done, Reuben, and the old hymn writer, whose song is in public domain. It's a great John Chris video about that. Anyway, Good Good Father, also a good John Chris video. It's on 2 lists, It As Well, on 2 lists, In Christ Alone, on 2 lists, No Longer Slaves, on 2 lists. Then Still is on 2 lists. And then the bottom 3 are only on 1 list. Great Are You Lord is only on the Pentecostal Charismatic list. Boldly I Approach, only on the Presbyterian list. Jesus, I My Cross Have Taken, only on the Presbyterian list. Good. All right, what should we make of these songs? All right, so let's take a closer look. And there's a lot to cover here. This is what you remember earlier we called situational analysis, the operant theology of hope. Regardless of what people say, they believe this is what's kind of in there. So let's look at space. Where is the action happening? Let's just look at a couple of words, like earth and heaven. So earth is used 3 times in 3 of the top 9 songs. Every time earth is used, it refers to trouble in which God can intervene, creation which can bring God praise, or a temporal place which the worshiper will soon leave. Heaven is used 4 times, but only in one song, interestingly. And it refers to the location of hope and a place of rest in God's presence. Should I smile too? key images, seas and storms used 7 times in 5 of the top 9 songs. Refers to earthly troubles, and that's without oceans being on the list. throne, used 3 times in 2 of the top 9 songs, refers to a sense of finality. God's will being done, evil being vanquished. So, you know, I don't think there's much to conclude from this, just interesting observations, seas and storms, which by the way, just a comment on that, I mean, that is sort of how apocalyptic literature uses the imagery of seas and storms. It's the reason why Revelation says, and the sea was no more. It's not because God hates the beach. It's because sea in Jewish apocalyptic writing is the place where chaos is and where the monsters live. And incidentally, many of Israel's enemies were seafaring people, chief of which was Rome, who used their ships to attack other people. So you would just have negative associations with the sea too, you know, if your enemies kept coming from there. So that's kind of the imagery. So if people are borrowing on biblical imagery, that's probably how they arrive at that. All right, now things get really interesting. Let's look at verbs. Why verbs? Because of time, right? Again, we said one of the dimensions of hope was time. Where is the action taking place? So when you look at verbs for both God and us, you kind of see that red is present tense, so national worship leader, kind of the mark there is about 59%, 24% in the past, 17% in the future. If we use that as kind of the gauge, Presbyterians are pretty much right on the money. Who's a little bit off here? Or not off, but who's a little bit different, right? Pentecostals, always us. No. 68%. Of the verbs are of the songs that they named are in the present tense. 11% in the past. Where are they taking from? So the focus on the future is generally about the same. 17, 19, 21, 9. Terrible difference. But big disparity. If you're going to sing so much about the present, what are you singing about a bit less past?
Are the demographics of these groupings of rather similar now, or because used to the Pentecostal charismatic back in its day was a different demographic than say Presbyterian.
Sure. I did not ask for race or ethnicity or anything like that. There is male or female, and generally, I'm trying to think here. I don't know off the top of my head what the gender question, but these were the songs that were on their list versus the songs that were on their list versus the songs that made it on the general top five. So then analyzing the verbs there. Okay, so then when you look, split out the verbs and say just us, let's just talk about people, what we're singing about, what we will do. In the general songs that national worship leaders kind of said, okay, God, you know, we were singing about us, 67% present tense, 18 future, 15 past, Presbyterians, very similar. Now it gets a little different, and actually, when you're singing about ourselves, charismatic, the songs on the Pentecostal charismatic worship leaders chose are quite a bit more about the future. So we have no problem saying, I will. And you could think through some of those examples from the song, from the list. When we get to God, this is the one I was most interested in. Where is God's action? This is the sharpest disparity yet. So when we sing about what God is doing, has done, will do, again, fair overlaps between the songs the Presbyterians chose and the national worship leader list. But the Pentecostal charismatics, when we sing about God, we want to sing about God in the now. So that's the sharpest disparity right there. Then, when we look at agency, unmistakably, all of the songs are about God and God's agency, not ours. Nobody was singing about what we can do in and of ourselves. But pronouns, this is the singular versus communal. And I'm hesitant to make too much out of this because, again, many psalms are in sort of the I, me, mine. But there's also something here to wonder about. Like, so what might explain this? Why are so many of the psalms chosen about me? And that's when it relates to that earlier
question about God will make it up to me, God will get me out of here, God will explain to me. So again, not surprisingly, you're 95%, 95%, 98%. So let's summarize a bit before we keep going. Imagery of the lyric shows immediacy and proximity of God to the worshiper. That's the throne, and earth, heaven. Worship songs that bring worshipers hope are disproportionately focused on the presence. We saw that. Especially, and you could add, especially songs that Pentecostals and Charismatics chose. These worship songs tend to lack a sense of narrative movement toward the future. I think of the nine, Cornerstone and In Christ Alone are the only ones that have a final stanza. When he shall come, it's trumpet sound, that's there. And then what's the last verse in Christ Alone? When he returns, you're calling him. Thank you, there it is. There it is. So two of the nine have, but another way to say it is seven of the nine don't have a narrative sense or a movement toward the future. So, and then the thing about the pronouns, worship songs that bring worshipers hope are nearly exclusively individualistic, or at least from an individual perspective. All right, what are we to make of this? Should we make too much of it? How do we be careful here? And what's our theological analysis of the situation? So there's a number of ways to explain this, okay? So one way to explain this is, hey, worship songs are about who God is. So, of course, they're going to sing about God in the present tense. And to be fair, a number of the verbs are is verbs or be verbs. Would be the proper way to say it, I think, right? Great are you, Lord. What is that? Past, present? I mean, technically it's present, but it's really like a stative verb. It's about who he is, you know? So that's tricky. So maybe it's just that these worship songs are doing what Christian worship songs have always done. For example, think about great are you, Lord. All of those verbs of the verse are stated in the present tense. You give life, you are love, you bring life, you give hope, you restore, great are you, Lord. But that's sort of just talking about the character of God. So maybe we don't want to make too much about this. That some, just for comparison, some ancient Cappadocian hymns, this is Matthew McGowan's work, the Phos Hilaron, all three verbs are in the present tense. The Gloria in Excelsis, all 12 verbs are in the present tense. Syriac, but then at the same time, there are Syriac hymns that tell stories in narrative form, and we don't have only two of these are in any kind of narrative sense. So maybe it's that these are what makes these songs of hope. It's not that they're singing about the future, but it's that confidence for the future is rooted in the nature of God. So you don't actually have to sing about the future to experience hope. You just have to sing about God. Does that make sense? So this is our. Caution pole on one side to say, careful now, let's not run away with these with conclusions here that may be wrong. It could just be that, hey, sing about God and you will experience hope. Fair enough. And we'll come back to that tomorrow. But explanation two is where the edge gets a little sharper. It may be that these are songs of hope because the conditions of the songwriter is pretty good. Now, here is where I don't want to be cynical, but I can include myself in this. But for each of these songs, life is relatively good. In Atlanta, Georgia, good father. In Redding, California. In Nashville, Tennessee. In Sydney, Australia. In Sophia, North Carolina. And in this particular chapter of my dissertation, I engaged with James Cone's work on the spirituals and the spirituality of the blues. He talks about slave spirituals. And Cohn talks very specifically about how there's so much eschatology in the spirituals. And it's all about a movement toward or a waiting for, come, you know, Jesus come, or one day I'll cross over, or we're going to get to the promised land. One of the sharpest kind of contrasts here is the use of Exodus imagery. The slave spirituals have they use Exodus, Promised Land imagery a lot. One of the 9 songs on the list uses Exodus imagery too. Can you think of which one it was?
No Longer Slaves.
No Longer Slaves.
Yeah.
And where does it locate the Red Sea event? As in, as already happened. You split the sea so I can walk right through it.
Yeah.
My fears are drowned in perfect love. Now that's fine. In one sense, so does the New Testament. But in another sense, what does it say about our need for rescue even now? Well, I don't need it. I'm just fine. But that was not the experience of slaves. We knew that, yes, we have been forgiven, but we still need a rescue. So one very real hypothesis is that singing about the present tense is the luxury of the privileged.
So all those demographics are just first world Americans.
They're all Americans. These are North American worship leaders on the list, on the email list. Yeah. But I'm just saying the songs that were named came from conditions of comfort. Almost regardless of where they're being sung. Now, it does bear true that two of the churches that I focused on, the Presbyterian Church and the Charismatic Church, the focus groups, the data kind of follows, you know, it mimics more or less the same shape with this national stuff. That was enough to make Jonathan leave. He's out of here. Yeah, he told me he was leaving early. We were going to stage a whole confrontation. But we do have to think about this. If we were singing songs that were written in Syria, would it be different? If we were singing songs that were written in the caravan, Central America, would that be different? So, politics aside, you just have to think about the conditions of the songwriter. So if the only songs we're singing are written by people who have a very comfortable present, we're not going to find songs of hope that have a sense of future to it. So okay, that was a question, you have any? So this was kind of the thing you were getting at.
Yeah, and I guess what I wonder, and it's hard to speculate, but yeah. We almost have a complete absence of songs of lament in modern worship.
Yeah.
And I guess my sort of hypothetical question is, I wonder if we did have songs of lament that were palatable for the ears of contemporary worshipers, would they find hope there?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's tough, Vinny, because you know, we all can name artists and projects and people who are trying to do that, but it just never makes headway. It doesn't sort of break in, which again, this would be a whole other kind of analysis, but it suggests that the vehicle of contemporary worship music reinforces power structures. So the powerful and the privileged write songs. It's reinforced by the rich and the powerful industries and the big and large churches and the big and large record labels that put on tours and buy spots on the radio and on it goes. And so all those things do is reinforce the power structures and divisions in society. So that's a shame about the contemporary worship industry. And now, the people that I know within it are good-hearted people. They don't mean for that to be the case. Nevertheless, every record label executive knows, if you were to go to find someone who's written even a great song of lament, but has no platform, you're not going to sign them. That person won't sell records.
Well, those aren't positive hits.
Not only is the theme a problem, but the person's lack of platform is a problem. So this is where the system is broken here, because in order for a record label to give you a voice, you have to already have a platform. Well, platform is just another word of saying you have a certain amount of power and privilege.
You also have to go global.
Yes.
More voice than just, yeah.
Yes.
And weekly worship planning, just in the trenches, doesn't happen in a vacuum. I mean,
no, these are all radio hits that people make.
But you've got I'll just say, run-of-the-mill worship leader with a volunteer worship band that has one and a half guitar players and a mediocre drummer.
Right.
You've got, okay, I need
and
a song.
And Sundays are coming.
I need a song of hope. Here's five of them. Two of those we can do well. And see, all the criteria that you have to get through before you can even make a theological decision.
I wish I had included this, but the profile of the demographic of the people who responded were a male volunteer who finds new worship music on YouTube. That's pretty much the profile of the response. So that's tough. It's a tall order to ask them to think through all this stuff, you know? Yeah. So this is not a criticism of the worship leader. It's just a way of saying we've got a system that is not doing anything to upset or cut against power structures here. So
based on some of what you're saying, it sounds like at some point you're going to be also addressing kind of are you going to get into like a missiological issue in the sense that there's always this question of songs. Do we export them to other countries and translate them, or do we let them write their own music? Because if we just export this stuff, we're not exporting hope to them potentially, because our hope is not their hope. And so
those are some real implications. And in disclosure here, Integrity Music was kind enough to fund a portion of my research, so I was able to do some private presentations to their team and even to their songwriters. Everybody wants to try to do what you're saying. Say, let's not just export, let's also help cultivate our, and Integrity in some ways, maybe more than others, have tried to do this. There was like a project from an Indian worship leader that they're trying to promote in Hindi and all this stuff. But the trick is always, when it comes down to it, what's the business model for this?
Mm-hmm.
How do you do that, you know? And so long as it's driven by industry, mm-hmm. we're going to have a hard time. Yeah.
But that also goes with, so your top 25 on a contemporary Christian station versus your top 25 gospel station.
That's
vastly different. Yes. And so the lament aspect is still there in very many underprivileged cultures in America, especially in predominantly African-American churches. You'll still get that, even though a lot of contemporary Christian music actually mirrors a lot of what at the time was gospel music,
yeah.
the old 7-Eleven, good father type, that call and response, that's African-American tradition.
Yes.
It's just that the power dynamic and the way the songs are arranged now fit a powerful or a more affluent structure as opposed to a more suffering aspect or a more lamentative aspect. But they're on the same structure.
Okay, let me make sure I'm understanding. So the structure of contemporary worship songs have mimicked gospel songs, but the content is different?
Content is different.
Yeah. Wow, that's interesting. Perspective from people who are more familiar with gospel music or even in African-American worship system, do these lists sound like, no, it'd be a very different situation and not.
It depends on the congregations. But if you're looking at, I would say, if you're looking at a congregation that, because there are African American churches that are very much more affluent, that would do many of these songs.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you would have a lot of them that would actually look a lot different.
Sure.
Where you would have more John P. Key, Ty Tribbett, things like that, that will have a much more traditional African American or traditional lament type.
Yes.
Or an understanding of suffering, afterlife, getting through how horrible it is to be in this country and this state.
Right.
I mean, that would, the past is very much still present in those situations.
Yes. Well, and even if, I'm trying to think of, being at ORU was the place where I was around a mix of styles the most, but it was funny because even back in the late 90s, you had kind of the chapel music team, and then you had Souls of Fire, which was like the black choir. Why do we have two different, why can't we, But our main worship leader when I was a student was an African-American guy, and he would introduce a lot of Fred Hammond stuff.
There you go,
Right? But I'm thinking, I love No Weapon, But so take a song like No Weapon. No weapon formed against me shall prosper, it just won't work. No. And then the next part is, God will do what he said he would do, but there's the future.
He will stand by his word, he will come through. That's hope, right? And so I don't know whether Fred's singing from a place of privilege or not, but at least he has a communal consciousness of hardship, and he's writing songs that will say to people, look, even if it ain't good right now, it's going to get better. God will come through. So the point at this moment is not to say, well, how good is that vision of the future and how much like the creed is it not? Okay, all we're saying right now is we're just talking about verbs. Like, is it even about the future? And so when you sing a song like Good, Good Father, which is every verb is in what God is doing right now. What's the first verse? But I hear your gentleness in the dead of night. Everything is, and you're saying, and you're doing, and you're calling, and you're this. And it's a present motion of God, which is fine. But that's very different than saying God will do what he said he would do. Right? Or pointing to the future. So, I can't prove this, but this is a strong hypothesis about what to say about these songs. Like, why is it so focused on the present? It might have something to do with who the writers are and where they're coming from. Another reason is the cultural moment. This is where sometimes people call this postmodernism. Lester, again, I've referred to Lester so much. I'm very, very grateful for his work. He was my external examiner on my dissertation, so I tried to include him a lot, so thank you. He passed me. But he did some good work comparing 18th century evangelical hymns with contemporary worship songs. You can Google this article. It's in a journal called The Artistic Theologian or something like that. It's really fascinating where even in 18th century evangelical hymns, basically there was always a final stanza, a one day kind of verse, a when we've been there kind of thing. And contemporary worship songs generally don't have that. In fact, I would go further. Pete Ward in the UK did an analysis of song books, like Songs of Fellowship. That's a bit more of a UK/global thing, Songs of Fellowship. And he said back in the 70s that the songs had shifted from a narrative of conversion to a narrative of encounter. He's right. But I think now there is just no more narrative. It's just encounter. It's just like, this is happening right now. And it's the best, you know. There's not a storied shape to it anymore. Could be what Charles Taylor, the Oxford philosopher, calls the loss of further purpose, or the loss of a telos in the secular age. This was one I was actually able to test a bit by the other questions I asked the worship leaders. So let me click through some of these questions, and then we'll do some final discussion here. So I told you I had asked them some A-B questions on there. Said, which statement brings you more hope? I didn't tell them what thing was about what dimension, but I put that in brackets for you so you can see it. So this question essentially has to do with the question of space. I'm going to heaven. Heaven is coming to earth. Which statement brings you more hope? Okay. Everybody pretty much says, yo, no, it's about heaven coming to earth. Great. Seems to be we're on the right track. Then I ask, this world is not my home, or this world will be transformed. And everybody says, this world is not my home. Well, I'm very confused now. You know, I thought you just said heaven is coming to earth. Only the Presbyterians, God bless them, with the statement there. Now here's one where both statements are true. Christ is here with me, and Christ will come again in glory. Now what should be shocking about this, I think, or what was shocking to me, is that Christ will come again in glory is verbatim a phrase from the Creed.
Yeah.
And yet, this is why I said earlier, I don't think people have any use for a doctrine of what's to come. It's not that they don't believe it, it's just that, what's the point? As long as Christ is here with me. So this statement actually will show up again because it's both a statement about space and a statement about time. Right?
space here, come again, but it's also about time now or come again. Here are some questions that are just about time. God will make things work out here and now. God will make all things well in the end. So again, everyone has the right kind of idea there. No. God will make all things well in the end. But then, victory is ours now, or victory is coming.
May I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
Our whole table came with this question earlier, and it's actually sort of coming back up again, and that is, in your demographics, any idea of the age of these folks? And here's why I asked that question. Yeah. Earlier it came up for one reason, but it's hitting me in the face again. You know, I'm not as young as everybody in this room, and we've laughed already. But as I find that as I get older, I do, as I look at the way things are going around me, I just start to go, I am so looking forward to the future when God does put everything right, which is something I would not have done 10 to 15 years
ago. Well, I'm with you in that.
I'm just curious. Is there any way
I'll find out. I'll dig through. I have the other chart somewhere. When I was building the slides, I didn't put that in. But I'll dig through and try to find it for you. There is hope. same question again. It is. Oh, no, this is not the same. Okay. It is well with my soul, or all will be well in the end. So not surprising why the song It Is Well showed up. Because all will be well in the end is a play on, is it Julian of Norwich? All will be well, all manner of things shall be well. And it is well with my soul, obviously, the hymn. So that's interesting. And then the Christ is here with me, Christ is coming in, just put that up there again, but think about the time dimension of that. All right, if we were to put this on a plot here of the space and time questions taken together, here being blue, green being there, orange being now, red being later or then, you can see where it lands. Another way to plot this out, just if you're visual in a different way, is like that. Green circle, Pentecostals, Charismatics. Blue is all, orange is Presbyterians. So everyone kind of leans in the here and now. Charismatics are a little bit more on the there, a little bit more of that split between earth and heaven. Let's see, this one's a better one for a little bit more accuracy here on here and there. Yeah. No, that's not true. So there is Presbyterian. So my circles were off on the other one. Just look at this one. Forget the other one. It's more accurate. Okay. Great. Questions, thoughts, comments? Are you troubled? Yes.
Yeah, I mean, just kind of playing devil's advocate and say, can't we blame our preachers?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's why I asked how many pastors were in the room, because if there weren't any pastors, we'd blame them.
Come on, Don.
What we say, what we pray, will be what we believe.
Yeah.
But it is, and I'm not discounting this is fascinating, but there's something about those three questions that were all about me and my story as opposed to God and his story. Mm-hmm. So what are what people hearing? In the preached word as well as in the songs.
No, I think you're right. You're right. And I haven't this... It was beyond the scope of this work to know what the causes were.
Right.
This is simply a snapshot of the situation.
Right.
Right? So if we're going to go farther back, well, what caused this situation? I don't know. But in my list of recommendations, which we'll do in session 8, it certainly includes a strong responsibility on pastors. You know, it can't be put all on worship leaders. Or even, to be fair, can't be put all on songwriters. Yep.
It makes me think of the shape note songs. You know that they're. Do you know about shape note?
I'm not sure if I do.
Some of them were some of the primitive Baptist churches, but They were pre-Civil War, a lot of them, when people died at a very young age.
Okay.
And a lot of them deal with the subject of death, and a lot of them are in the minor mode.
Oh, wow.
And I'm sure, you know, just thinking about this now, they probably deal with the hereafter a lot more.
Yeah. Well, that is true. I mean, I think even Lester's work of saying, look, even 18th century evangelical hymns, which were not... so I contrasted with like slave spirituals, which you can say, oh, there's a major difference here in power structures, obviously. But the hymns would not have been, but even back then. So there is something that has shifted over time. Could it be that with the modern age of medicine and technology and all of this stuff, we're just not as desperate? And so actually life is, well, we're okay. You know, we can figure this out. Versus older songs would have been like, oh dear God, had a sort of a more real outlook toward life, like we could die tomorrow.
Of course, you know? That's in the United States.
Sure.
You know, we've done some mission work in different countries. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's true. Technology and medicine and science has not saved everyone. Yeah. So again, the people that are choosing the songs that I mentioned are male and white. I did not ask age. Should have asked age. That would have some bearing, wouldn't it? There you go. All right, questions, comments, thoughts. Hate to leave you on a sour note. So let's
the whole time I've been thinking about this in our affluent first world that we've lost our spiritual depravity, and in that we think the hope is more here and now, and because we don't have that, we've lost that aspect of, if it hadn't have been for what Jesus had done and is doing, that we would not have a future and a hope.
Well, the thing is, there was not a loss of talking about sin. In fact, many of these songs talk about the cross and talk about forgiveness. It's just that they... they're not emphasizing the future, sort of the what we called our normative and formal theology of hope, the eschatological vision. They're not talking about Christ's return in glory, future judgment. I mean, Cohen makes a big deal about how much the spirituals talk about future judgment. Because if you're being mistreated, you need to know that somebody's going to make a thing. Somebody's going to set this
right. I guess that's my point. Yeah. If we were truly... understanding our spiritual depravity, or even going back to the paradigms of encounter, even mission being sure and for, we don't do a whole lot of confession and assurance of ongoing.
You're wondering if those things are connected. I don't know. Maybe. Although I just got to say that in general, the songs are comfortable talking about sin and forgiveness, but just not. Future.
Well, we've divorced. I think divorced that of aspect of we would not have a future.
Right. Or future judgment.
I think there's something to say to that in terms of the reason why you worship and like what your worship nature is.
Mm.
It changes when you truly understand that God has recreated. Mm. That you have a fall. And then you have a recreation, and people who worship, like it's depicted in Revelation, like it changes the way you worship. If you're worshiping just for the sake of, oh, God is good, that's different worship than the Lord has saved me from myself. Like it's and He will come again. Like that's a different type of worship. Not to say that one is lesser than the other, but that the nature in and of itself is different.
Yeah, or at the very least, the past redemption is not connected to future new creation. So someone said, I was at the NAAL, the North American Academy of Liturgy, presenting this part of it. And someone said, it's almost like a punctiliar view of history rather than a narrative view. So the punctiliar view means just events that just happened versus that there's a connection here. So if you shake the string on this part, it causes movement on this part. Like our past redemption means something for our glorious new creation. That
connectedness is lost. So I don't think I'd be willing to say that there's a loss in the sense of redemption. I just think the connection between redemption and hope is lost.
Yeah, I don't think the average congregant or the average person is thinking about how God doubling the provision, if you will, of the fall, like making something better, despite it happening. Like, I don't think they're thinking about that.
No, you're right. You're right. So it's, yes, something about the fall, my sin, Jesus died, heaven. You know?
I was just going to make a comment. I think one of the most important things that you said is, as long as we allow industry to sort of lead the way in worship, we're going to be in a pickle. And I'm going to date myself here, too. I actually remember sitting with Steve Camp, if anyone knows who he is, in New York City, like, back in the late 90s, and us having a conversation about how, you know, this is when, like, Nashville was, you know, CCM was booming, and people were getting managers, and it was becoming
an industry.
Yeah. And, you know, his greatest fear was that, you know, we're going to lose ministry, we're going to lose theology, we're going to lose, and I think, like, I just graduated from worship school that has a huge focus on songwriting. Mm. And my question is, why are we afraid to be writing songs of lament? Oops, said that. Like, why are we not writing for our congregations? Why are we not, you know, where God has us planted? Why are we so afraid that we're not pulling from the top songs on industry charts, you know, and instead finding out what are the needs in our congregation.
Are they
theological? Are they, and start writing songs that are going to meet those needs.
Yeah. And to be fair, some are.
Yeah, some are.
It's just that we're not going to hear about it because they don't have the mechanism of the industry behind it.
But does that matter? You know what
I mean? It doesn't matter.
Because if it's meeting the need of the congregation you're in, and this is one of the things I'm doing, is I'm starting to, like, as a worship leader, I'm in a new church last 3 months, and I'm starting to introduce new songs.
Good.
You know?
Good.
And I don't really, you know, all I care about is, you know, are they meeting the needs of the people that are in front of me?
Yep.
I'm not, you know, I don't care, you know, oh, does somebody really pick this up? You know?
Right.
How is the hook on that? You know, care less.
Right.
Like, is it drawing them into the presence of the Lord? Is it helping them go deeper in their relationship with God? Like, that, at the end of the day, you know, should be our most important thing. But as long as industry continues to drive, you know, we have a problem.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right, and they are out there, and when I hear about it more and more all the time, people are doing it, and they're sort of saying, we don't care about the label of this or that, we're just gonna. So it's happening. It's hard to gauge how widespread, you know, it is. But you're right, that is certainly one of the takeaways. Say, we don't have to only sing the songs we hear on the radio. I mean, it is interesting, like, a lot of the top 9 songs are all songs that had some measure of radio play or, you know, or big success. Maybe not all of them, but certainly how Good Good Father put out there because of Tomlin's cover of it, you know.
But he didn't even write that.
No, of course not.
The Housefires wrote that.
Right, so, no, that's right. Yeah, and that's the Sophia, North Carolina reference there, you know, so.
Atlanta.
Because
they came out of the worship school I went to.
Oh, cool.
They're, you know, so that's what I'm saying. So, and I'm not disagreeing, like, what you said about, you know, writing from a place of privilege. Like, I know those guys, so I took that with the heart at which you said it.
I'm so hesitant to, because it's not a criticism.
Yeah, no, I know.
Every song I've written can be said is written from a place of privilege. So I'm.
But that's my point. Yeah. Is like, those guys sat in a room. They wrote out of a place of where they were with the Lord. And so, like, that's my point, is as worship leaders, if we start taking this really seriously, why can't we?
We can do the same thing.
Yeah,
that's right.
Like,
the takeaway is not to say, oh, those guys shouldn't be writing. It's
exactly.
To say, everybody should be
exactly.
writing.
Exactly. Yeah. But why people know that song is because of Chris Hong.
No,
it's not
absolutely.
Because of Housefires necessarily.
Right.
So.
I want to save that for my last session of 11. Nothing left to talk about. But it is part of the thing of even from a ritual studies perspective, it's hard to change conventions, like social conventions or the convention of a ritual, the norms of it. So once it gets, once verse, chorus, bridge, chorus, eighth note build, you know, drum chorus, once that becomes the thing, it's like, it's very hard to move against that and hope for the same sort of widespread use, because people are familiar with a certain convention and then they just do that, you know. That's not to say, like your point, that we shouldn't do it anyway. Who cares?
I was raised Pentecostal, charismatic, so we drank snake poison on the rag. I'm kidding. I'm sitting here thinking about this and wondering, is it possible to push back on this conclusion and suggest that I was always taught your faith, and this is just a product of being raised in the community I was raised in, is not something that you will obtain it only in the future. It is not something that only occurred for those who lived before you. But it's something that you can experience here now.
Yeah.
And without that now, mm-hmm. You either fall into just apathy,
mm-hmm.
or flippancy. It's just like, well, it's all over there, so
right.
It doesn't affect me.
Right.
And irrelevancy.
Yep.
And so there was this push to say, God can be experienced now, just not in the past or only in the future.
Yes.
So in some sense, is it so bad that some of our hope songs are dealing with the here and the now?
No. You're absolutely right, and I hate to keep doing this with different comments, but this will be a great way to be able to end to our day, is that's exactly what Session 7 will say. But listen, this is why. So if we stop right here, what we would have done as a methodology, for any of you who appreciate this stuff from an academic standpoint, is we would have analyzed the situation and then done theological reflection on the situation and then come up with action items. But what we're going to do next is we're going to then say, but the songs are only one part.
Yeah.
Tomorrow morning we'll start with emotion and experience in the presence of God. Then we'll talk about the services and what my focus groups taught me about their own experience of hope. And then we'll find ourselves in a pickle, because we'll say, well, I was very discouraged about the songs, but now I'm really encouraged about the services. What do we do? And then you let both of those things interrogate our theological conclusions. So our theological conclusions right now, we feel very assured of them. We're like, well, I know why it is. Because da, 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 da. And I'm the same way. It's like, well, but it's because we're self-centered. It's because we're rich. And it's because, you know. Tomorrow, we'll call into question those assumptions and say, well, are you sure? Or is there another reason why these songs are able to do their work, even though they don't say what we want them to say? That's where we'll begin tomorrow. All right. Thanks, guys.